Welcome to Beyond the Hedge, a podcast brought to you by Scribehound, where we go in search of the people, places, traditions and tales that shape Britain's rural landscape. In the 1820s and 30s, the writer Mary Russell Mitford, in various now long-defunct magazines, had 100 sketches of rural life published. Her work painted English villages as places full of people. The English village, she wrote, is a small world of our own, where we know everyone, are known to everyone, are interested in everyone, and are authorised to hope that everyone feels an interest in us. For a long time, I guess right up until perhaps the 1950s, Mitford would have continued to recognise the English village. But now, almost everything has changed. Village pubs are closing at an alarming rate, village schools are going the same way, and second homeowners now complain about tractors driving through villages and hounds meeting on Boxing Day. A little over a year ago, I was driving through Norfolk when I came across an egg vending machine in the village of Great Snoring. It was a remarkable find. Not only were the pickled quail's eggs delicious, but the contraption itself was pretty amazing. It later struck me, though, that in what had presumably once been a thriving and busy village where I guess you could have probably bought a pint and a loaf of bread, the only place now open is the egg vending machine. In my mind, it became a symbol of how the English village has changed. And I decided to track down the person who owns it, a man who I later learned is called David Perrone, whose family have lived on the same farm for over 150 years. I drove to Norfolk one sunny spring day and sat with David in his farmyard by his walnut tree, where the birds sang.
We've been here since 1847. We came from a village called Barney, right, which is where my wife Helen is from. And we came to Top Farm, it was then Manor Farm. It was actually owned by a family called the Dugmores. So it wasn't, the other farm in the village was owned by Henry Lee Warner. I only ever hear the Perrone side of it. So there might be another story. This farm came up for sale, and it would have been my great-great-grandfather agreed with Henry Lee Warner that he wouldn't bid against him when this was sold, on the condition that he could keep the tenancy of this farm and become tenant of Lower Farm.
Okay.
So what was called the Great Snoring Farm is actually two farms.
Right.
What the division is, I haven't got a clue.
So what I'm interested in this episode is talking about how much villages have changed. And I mean, Snoring appropriately feels like quite a sleepy place now. But what would have been here before?
There have been three pubs. Two I can remember. But there would have been a bakery. The village shop closed in 1983.
Yeah, yeah.
As did the school. But I think you have to remember the work in... Well, my grandfather, I've looked at his wages. He has a very good records. In 1933, this farm would have employed over 60 people.
60?
Yeah.
Wow.
So they all had to live here because... they'd either come to work via horse or push bike, so
yeah.
There weren't too many farm workers could have a car in those days. And that's why a lot of what's actually happened in this village, a lot of what I would actually call semi-detached cottages, have now become a detached cottage because someone's bought both halves and made it one.
Presumably second home ownership in this part of Norfolk is quite...
It's a contentious issue.
I remember very distinctly when I was writing my first book, going to see a reed cutter, and I expected him to live, you know, by the coast because he's a reed cutter and a crab fisherman, and he lived sort of way back inland, which was where he could afford to live because everything, you know,
yeah, on this side. The guy who's cutting our grass today, he lives FOC in an estate house, and so it doesn't, if you spoke to this to Lucy, she'd tell you how many houses there are in Great Snoring. And and they were
what
all...
What's the population now of Great Snoring?
It's about 120, 130. I think you'll see a very... if you go back to the 1902 census, you'll see quite a high figure, which is artificially high because there was a workhouse in the village which did for Walsingham, Great Snoring, Little Snoring and Thursford, and is actually called Thursford Castle.
I saw it for sale the other day in Country Life for like quite a lot of money.
Yeah, well, you could have
What kind of things would people end up in the workhouse, or what would they have ended up in the workhouse for?
A lot of it. I mean, some people would have been, it would just be as simple as they were seasonal workers and they go in there for the winter because they got no work.
And they would have been doing what, just menial jobs on the land?
Yeah. And they were, one I can think of, quite an old boy called Bob Kendall, who lived in the village. He was a carpenter by trade. And obviously he'd run out of work in the self-employed. Run out of work in the winter time.
So that's where he'd go.
That's where he'd go.
Yeah. Do you think people then thought that, because we can look at the way villages are now and feel quite sad about them being empty, hollowed out, do you think people then liked their lives?
I think the saddest effect of what second home ownership has done to a village, especially like this. One, when I was a child, I knew who lived in every house, and now I don't. But it also prevents young people buying houses in villages because they can't afford it.
Yeah.
It takes them off the property ladder. I mean, it's quite interesting. I mean, my brother's had on the market my aunt's old house, which is an ag tie house she built in the 60s. Nothing wrong with it, just very 60s.
Yeah, yeah.
I think he now might have sold it on the third or fourth attempt. But the first two people who wanted to buy it to knock it down to build a new house.
Really?
And it was $650,000. And it's a very expensive building plot.
And then in terms of farms on the edge of villages, how much bigger have those become?
I think we all become more specialists. Like, we're really a specialist poultry farm.
Yeah.
But the problem is you have to be the size you need to be competitive. And also the cost of labour has gone up per person. Mm. It's gone up enormously. And the machinery, to be fair, I'm glad I'm out of arable farming. We used to have 900 acres of arable. I quite enjoyed it, but I enjoy what I do now.
Yeah,
so it's a very weird, I'm in a lucky situation at the moment because, as you can recall, 18 months ago, there was no eggs on the supermarket shelves.
Yeah, yeah.
And at the moment, everyone's trying to make sure that doesn't happen again. So we're actually being paid a sensible amount of money.
Do you think we've seen, in this village that we're in now, you've got great snoring and little snoring. One, it's not that one's bigger than the other, right? It's that one's further away than...
One was snoring Magna and one was snoring Parva years ago.
Oh, really? How long ago?
I'd say beginning of the Victorian era.
Really? Okay.
And it was spelt slightly different. They think it sort of originated from a man called Snare. And Ing is it's really a Viking word for a village, which is how you gain, like, Fakenham. Was a man probably called Fake, believe it or not. He got bigger. He had a village, so it became Faking. Then it got bigger, so it became Faking Ham. And it's the same with, and then like with a town like Northampton, a ham became a ton. So it's just how they grew in size. I think going back to what I said about when we had the workhouse, I think you'd find Great Snoring, in theory, had a population of over 300.
And if you went into the pub, even when you were young in Snoring?
I never went in a pub when I was young.
No.
That was gone before I was fit to drink.
Really, really, yeah.
We now have a social club.
Yeah, yeah.
Which
is that well?
It's not. I would say it's well supported by, not necessarily well supported by, people who live in Great Snoring. But it is quite. The history of it. It was the room. It's the building itself was originally a reading room built after the First War, like a village library. Then it became. Then it gained a billiard table, came snooker table, and then became a men's institute. The last village, the last pub closed, and so they decided they'd form a social club. My parents put a lot of work in it, and some of the people who used to, I think when the men's institute shut, I think they had six members. The licensing rules, we've altered how we operate, and we operate near enough as a pub now. But when we were at its height, we'd have probably 600 members. We used to do harvest here, and that would take us 3 weeks. And when I started having a contract to do my farming, my harvest would last about 3 or 4 days. So you don't, it's all a bit of a whirlwind.
Would there have been a feeling in the past of, we're in harvest and now harvest is finished? Was there a sort of celebration feel, or is that kind of going back
further? Probably a bit further. I mean, harvest festival is a genuine celebration of finishing of harvest time. Don't get me wrong. As I tell people what we do here, we have harvest every day.
Yeah, that's true. And you celebrate every day. So you now have the quail's eggs and duck
we
eggs.
We don't do duck eggs anymore.
Right.
That was one of the processes we got out of, well, really thanks to bird flu. But we used to say we used to have a breed called a Cocky Campbell.
Yeah, they look like a mallard, but kind of longer.
Longer and darker. There is a bit of mallard in them.
They can't fly, can they?
I never made them try. You said like it was a commercial variety of the
yeah.
So it was the idea behind having it's a smaller than a white Peking duck. So the eggs are smaller, still a white egg, but they didn't eat so much food. And our interest is when the food started to get very expensive, eat less food, which is the quail.
Do you think people who are moving into villages, are they sympathetic towards kind of rural life?
Some and some. I probably put newcomers into, or foreigners, as Norfolk people would say, into two categories. You have some that want to enhance what is there, embrace what is there, and be part of what is there. And then you also have people who want to change what is there into what they think should be there. I hope you understand what I mean.
Yeah.
And it is so, they probably don't appreciate being woken up by a tractor on a Sunday morning. Or with modern farming, you see more working 24/7 than you used to, say, 30 years ago. I mean, I finished college, we'd never used to combine on, very rarely combine on a Sunday.
Yeah.
It'd have to be a really wet harvest to make us work. And then we wouldn't, unfortunately, father sent me away for an education. I worked for a family called the Strawsons in Nottinghamshire, growing spuds. Tates, as they'd say in that part of the world. And we used to work long hours. We had a very wet harvest the year I was in Nottinghamshire, and we'd think of nothing until combine until 2 or 3 o'clock in the morning. And that's more, which in Norfolk, then you wouldn't have seen.
Yeah.
You might have seen 9 o'clock.
And what's your sort of prognosis for, you know, Norfolk villages in England in general? I mean, do you think, are we going to see people moving back to them?
I don't think you'll ever see people moving back to them because there's not the jobs. I mean, I said to you earlier, you know, back in the 30s, this farm employed 60 people. What possible business can you have here that can run efficiently, that can employ that number of people? And I mean, unless we suddenly go into growing strawberries or something like that. I mean, I went round an asparagus farm, and they have over 1,000 people on site, but they don't live in houses. They live in mobile homes. Most of them were Eastern European. And it was quite interesting. As we went round the farm, they got some, what I'd call French beans or low beans, and they were hand-picking them. And one of the other guys on my call said, what made you do it? To keep the people here longer. Because they're charging you, they're stinging you 40 quid each a week.
So we're sitting this is the kind of, the last shop in Snoring, which is the famous egg vending machine. What was the idea behind?
We needed to move our shop, and I suppose I'd always hankered after a vending machine because I like getting my money. I think it's a good description. But also what it also does is we can really keep control of stock. When we used to run an honesty box, and we had to move it because we put a holiday let on the farm, and so we needed to move it. It's a lot better place because it enables us, it's right by the farm entrance.
Yeah.
So it's a lot more.
How many customers a day do you get to
be there? Oh, probably no more than 20 or 30. You wouldn't be, I mean, I know in the old days, and if we had a particularly bad bout of nicking, either eggs or money or both, the policeman would say, we really need to speak to you about crime prevention, Mr. Perrone. You really need to sit there all day. And we don't take enough money. We take about 600 quid a week. It's good.
Oh, that's all right.
It's fine. Essentially, the idea of selling the eggs, we have a lot of the dirty eggs we wash. And that was actually the original interest in doing it. We now do a bit more. We sell graded eggs there now.
Can we go and...
We'll have a little look.
To our right, where we were chatting, there were some amazing barns with red pantile roofs, and we walked by them on our way to the vending machine in its bright yellow shed.
That was built in 1977, and that was the first thing we actually did was the Queen Silver Jubilee in it as a village.
Yeah.
The rest of these, I haven't got a clue. That one, that barn there, all the old granary type barns, they had a big entrance door. Then they would have a wooden floor. Then they would have a small exit door. So it was a granary. They'd put all the grain still on the on straw in the barn, then obviously then they don't need, you don't need the room to go out. So that would have been the original entrance door, and that's got a door similar width, but no bigger than those sort of two personnel doors the other side. Yeah. And the wooden floor was to stop the horse's hoof shoes causing a spark.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
That's amazing, isn't it?
The egg vending machine is really quite a thing. There are lots of display windows, and there's everything from trays of hen's eggs to just straight pickled quail's eggs to pickled quail's eggs with saffron to pickled quail's eggs with chilli. And there are even walnuts from David's tree.
It's about 14,000 quid, the machine.
Wow. Which is not inconsiderable.
No. But it is a lot easier to operate. The biggest problem was actually not apart from collecting the money, was actually guaranteeing the freshness of the egg. So with these, we can, because we put the eggs in and out of, so people buy a tray or half a dozen or one dozen or whatever, so we can keep tabs on the age of the egg. What used to happen on our old shop, you'd have old dears, and they'd want to buy, if they're buying six eggs, they might spend 20 minutes sorting through the eggs to get the biggest six eggs they could buy for their buddy.
What's your favourite? I'm gonna get some now.
I like the saffron because it takes the, I like the chilli for fun, but the saffron gets rid of the harshness, the sharpness of the vinegar.
Yeah.
I don't know which ones you've tried and which ones you haven't.
So. The new branding's great.
Yeah, we've done it that for a long while.
Some years ago, a lovely man called Mark Law, who lives on the Norfolk-Suffolk border, wrote to me to ask if I would like his great uncle Lijah's old hammer gun. His uncle Lijah was a famous Norfolk poacher, and Mark no longer had any need for it. I drove down to pick it up, and I realised I wasn't just picking up an old gun, but I was picking up a remarkable piece of rural history. Every village had at least one poacher not so long ago. And when we were standing there in David's shed, David explained to me that poaching made sense when game was worth something, and lots of people had very little.
Well, game is no longer worth anything. I've never witnessed it, but you often hear tales of partridges, especially being burial partridges, exchanging money for no money.
Yeah.
I mean, my father always used to quote me. He was, we had a farm at Creek, and the farm at Creek used to have a lot of game, and the pheasants in 1947 came to more money than the crop of wheat.
Which is amazing to think now.
In a brace of pheasants then, in the £7 a brace, without any, what it would be, make pheasants worth now, I haven't got a clue.
Yeah.
But also, you have to remember, with game, it wasn't on the meat ration.
Okay, interesting. Yeah.
And so it wouldn't have been, so it would have been worth more for that reason alone. But also, if you can go out, you also got to remember, people's wages were probably a five for a week. And so to go out, you weren't probably going to go and get £7 a brace. If you can go out one night a week, that's nearly a month's wages.
Yeah.
So, and you can't, and that's how people are. But, I mean, partridges are worth, I think you can get 25p.
The end of the village poacher.
There's no money in it.
After I spoke to David, I got in touch with Anna Jones. Anna is a farmer's daughter who spent a long time working for the BBC. And a couple of years ago, she wrote a very good book called Divide, which is really about the differences between town and country people, or it's actually about differences as they're perceived. She thinks that to solve environmental problems and problems that exist within our food system, we need to kind of get back together again, and we need to start listening to each other and talking to each other. I really like her outlook. She's very thoughtful and very respectful, and she spent a lot of time thinking about how villages have changed.
I'm sitting in my bedroom in my house in Shrewsbury in Shropshire.
And is that county is one that you've lived in for a very long time, have you, your whole life? You're a farmer's daughter.
Yep, I was born in the little cottage hospital in Oswestry, which closed down gosh, I think it closed down in about 1989 or something like that. My family have been farming on the Shropshire borders since, I went back as far as the mid-1700s in the family tree, and that's on both sides. That's mum's side and dad's side. So our particular family tree of Joneses haven't left the Welsh borders area for very much at all.
Has that border changed quite a lot over time? The Welsh border, has it moved?
Yeah, oh gosh, yeah. I think Oswestry has switched hands between the English and the Welsh 12 or 13 times, and it finally settled in the hands of the English around 1530, something like that. I have got the precise date. I wrote it in my book, actually, but I can't bring it to mind.
So, and quite some time ago.
Yes, so there were lots of skirmishes, which, and you can, you know, Offa's Dyke runs right past Mum and Dad's house.
Yeah, well, I'd love to talk about that, but what we've got to talk about today is the English village. So you've written a bit about your book, The Divide, which was a real success. I think my mother actually told me about that book first. She said, have you read this book? Because it's really interesting and touches on a lot of things that that I'm interested in.
Oh, thanks to your mum.
Yeah. No, she really enjoyed it, actually. But you also wrote a piece last year on the changing face of the English village.
Yeah, this year, actually. Came out in CPRE's magazine, the Campaign to Protect Rural England. And they asked me to write about the changing face of English rural villages and, you know, those common flashpoints between locals and incomers, which we all know about. And so I profiled the village of Bashchurch in Shropshire, which is where my great grandparents on my mother's maternal side lived from 1912, and looked at how the village changed through the 20th century and what it is now. And my mum was born there in the old smithy. My great-grandfather was the blacksmith in the village. And it's amazing. One thing, the house that my mum was born in was sold in 1964, and my mum believes it was sold for £500. It had no electricity, no running water. It was this beautiful black and white framed timber building. Anyway, it was sold, and I had a quick scout around to see what it's worth now. The average house price in the village is £350,000, and that particular house where my mother was born is worth more than double that.
And where are people commuting to?
Well, I mean, a lot of people these days are working from home. I think that's really driven this exodus into the countryside.
And it's driving up house prices.
Oh, it is. Well, I'm one of them, because I left the farm when I was 18 to go to university, and I never really came back. I got a job in the city, so I moved to Birmingham first, then to Manchester, then to Bristol, and worked for the BBC for many years, and didn't think I would ever be able to come back. But the pandemic changed the way that we all work, and now with the new flexible way of working, the first thing I did was get out of the city and come home to Shropshire. So I am one of those people, and it's quite weird being a local and an incomer at the same time, and feeling that experience from both sides.
This podcast, it all started actually with quail's eggs and has ended up here. So what it is that there's a little village called Snoring in Norfolk, and I went to go and see the guy. I've been a regular user of the egg vending machine in Snoring, and this guy topped it up with his eggs. It's a really cool thing, actually. He spent quite a lot of money on it. It's really impressive. But I wanted to know a little bit about it, because the thing that struck me in this village is that it's the last place you can buy anything. The egg vending machine is the last shop in Snoring. And a couple of people told me locally that there used to be, I think, one pub there at least within living memory. And when I tracked this guy down, David Perrone, and his family have been tenants on the same farm for I think the best part of 150 years. And he told me all about the egg vending machine. But he also told me that when he was young, there was a school there. There was a bakery there, I think. There was a shop there. So it's just completely changed. And he said to me that the thing that really stands out to him is that for the first time in his life, he doesn't know every single person in the village. Mm. And that, I think, is fascinating. And he also said that the farm that he's on, and I almost couldn't believe this, but a staggering number, he said, when his family first moved there were 60 people who were working on the farm over the course of the year doing various things. And you know, now You know, it would be sort of, I think, him and his son and maybe his other son. So just a complete change. So that was why I sort of decided, you know, it was time to learn more about the English village, and I thought you would be a great person to speak to.
Yeah, I mean, gosh, the village of snoring. I'd love to go there.
There's actually great snoring and little snoring.
Is
but
there?
He said to me, he's great. He's like...
I've known both in my
life. He knows everything.
Yes.
About this place, and he just said, actually, it's nothing to do with sleeping at all. He said there was somebody called Snare, and it was snaring because of that, and then it's been corrupted into snoring. So, but it's nice, you know, the quails from Great Snoring are a really nice idea.
And you know what, his experience of not knowing who everyone is anymore, I think that's felt from the other way as well, because when I wrote this piece about Bashchurch, I joined the village Pilates class. And just to get
that's
to
a
know
very modern
people.
Phenomenon.
Yeah, and yeah, in the village hall every Thursday morning, because it was difficult to get to know people, because these villages have become quite, everyone keeps themselves. There isn't the community feeling necessarily that there would have been, that I remember from when I was a kid. Maybe there is, but I couldn't find a way to tap in. So I thought, well, I'm going to have to join a club in order to actually get to meet people. And the Pilates class were a lovely bunch of people, and they always go for a coffee in the farm shop afterwards. So I joined them.
I'm getting a real picture of this village now.
It was nice. And so we all went for a coffee, yeah, and then I was asking them where they were all from. And they'd all moved to the area. That none of them were what you'd call a local. And they were mostly retirees or getting towards that age as well. So they were, you know, they had the money, they had the disposable income. They'd sold a house in London or somewhere, and they'd been able to buy something much bigger here in Shropshire. They really wanted to feel part of a community. But when I asked them, oh, well, who were the real locals? They sort of looked at each other and said, I don't know who the locals are. I don't know any.
Yeah, it's really interesting. I stood next to a gamekeeper not long ago, quite near snoring, and there were some barns that we were looking at, really nice old barns. And I said to him, you know, at some point those will probably get turned into houses and you know, and people will move in. And he said to me that really makes him sad, because the people who move in are often not people who understand the countryside as he understands the countryside. And he said, you know, they'll probably have a cat or two cats, and they'll have a badly behaved dog. And I thought that was a really interesting thing, because, you know, the countryside needs, in many places, more people. You know, I used to live in Dumfries and Galloway, and that's a county that can do with more people. But I do think that it is often the case that people move in who perhaps don't understand the countryside in the way that local people do. Do you think that's fair?
I think that's fair, and I think don't necessarily understand the impact that something that would appear completely normal to them would have. So, for example, one thing my dad always feels really sad about is all of the farm names around where we live are connected to families that have lived there for many, many years. And when they eventually get sold, somebody from outside the area will buy it. And Dad says the first thing they do is change the name of the farm. And
really? You'd almost think that would be like bad luck or something.
No, I think it's because people want it to be called something like Sundown or Pebbles, or I don't know, they call it something,
yeah,
I don't know, something profound or something that means something personally to them. And Dad says, but that's fine, but what they don't realise, he said, I'm sure they're not doing, they don't mean anything when they do it, but what they don't realise is that they are wiping out centuries of history there and heritage and a lineage that has lived in that house. And people, the local people will always talk about, you know, because there's so many Joneses and Davises and Evanses, yeah, where I'm from, you know, my dad is never called Tony Jones, it's Tony Craiglin. And my friend Kerry's dad,
because that's where he farms.
Yeah, that's where he's farm. And, you know, my friend
Kerry, really,
he's not John Davis, he's, you know, John Pengraig. Or,
you get that on the Western Isles as well.
Exactly.
So there's a guy,
exactly,
I went to go and see called Angus MacDonald, and he's called Angus MacDonald Kylas because his farm is Kylas, because everybody around there, yep, is Angus MacDonald, which is exactly
the same.
It's really funny.
And it's you can tell so much from those names, and I think when you do change them into another name, it severs that link with the past. And maybe that isn't important if you move in. I don't know.
I really like, though, as well, when you get field names and nobody knows any longer why they're called that.
Oh, yeah, like Mill Field and things. And you find out that it used to have a water mill there or something. Yeah, I love that.
Yeah. And there was one the other day I got told, somebody said to me, just head up there to Flanagan's, it's like Flanagan's 12 Acres or something. And I said, who's Flanagan? And he looked at me and he said, don't know. He said, no one knows, which is a really nice thing, because you've got this kind of history there hidden, you know, this ground, this land has been worked by a long forgotten person. So the history is kind of, you know, it's this presence and absence thing, which I think is really interesting.
Oh, yeah.
And actually really gets to the heart of, I think, some of like the uncanniness about villages. I mean, you know, with closed down chapels and all of that sort of thing, and buildings that you look at and you think, oh, that looks a bit odd, that house. And then you realise it used to be a pub.
I remember going to the shop in Lunkless with my granddad to get his paper, and he would always buy me a little sweet, and really old school little shop, and that's a house now. And you just think, gosh, wonder how many people remember that now, that when it was a shop, because I was tiny, I can only just remember it, and it doesn't even look like a shop, it just looks like a house now. So it's,
yeah,
history is probably gone forever. Not even sure if the owners of the house know it was a shop.
It's really interesting that, you know, my parents used to live near a small village in Dumfries and Galloway, a village called Dunsker, and they decided actually that it would be hard to get old there because there was no shop, you know, there was no pharmacy. There was a pub that opened one or two nights a week. So you had to drive kind of 10 or 11 miles into Dumfries. And I think you have this odd thing now where young people feel that villages are no longer really places for them because, you know, there's no work and the houses are too expensive in some instances. But old people feel that they can't live there either because you don't have the services. I mean, I was reading that since, I think, 2000, Herefordshire has lost 37 services. So things like primary schools, they've lost 18 post offices. Mm. And that's, you know, I was on Harris the other day in Tarbert, which, I mean, it's a town really rather than a village, but the Bank of Scotland branch was closing down. Now, like, so people in Tarbert would have to go all the way to Lewis, which is, you know, probably the best part of an hour and a half. So there's that as well, I think, which is just, it maybe gets forgotten about, is how hard it is increasingly to live in small villages.
Oh, yeah. And my personal view on this is, I don't know, is it controversial? I don't know. I think it's common sense, but we'll see. But the fact that you've got these villages, many of which are dying, just because they've got very expensive houses in them doesn't mean that they are thriving villages. A lot of them, what do they call them, dormitory villages and things like that. You know, they don't have a thriving culture, economy of its own, a population, that kind of thing. And yet when people seem to agree that that's what our rural villages need. Oh, we need to get the post office. We need to get the pub. We need to get the affordable housing so the people that work in these places can afford to live where they work. And yet, when it actually comes to the opportunity to create those things, what's the first thing that happens? There's, you know, people object to the planning because...
Yeah.
There's and it's such a hypocrisy, and it drives me insane. And it's kind of, we have this imagined community in our mind, which is, oh, it's where there's a lovely thriving congregation in the local church and the village school is bustling and we have a shop that we go and get our shopping from and we have a pub that we all go into, like the Archers. And there's this whole romanticism around this imagined community. And then as soon as people try to put the infrastructure in place to make that a reality, people object to it because, oh, actually, no, affordable houses don't look very pretty. They look a bit ugly and I don't want to have to look at those. Or, you know, this might attract the wrong kind of person to the village. And how, we've got to get over the NIMBYism, haven't we? Let's get it out there. We have got to get over that before we're going to fix any of these problems.
I remember as well, very distinctly, there was a meeting in the village pub in Dunsker because the landlord said he couldn't make it work anymore and people were quite sad about it, those who used it regularly. And there was a crisis meeting in the pub and like the whole village turned up. You know, there were people there who'd never been in the pub once. And the thing that was funny is that, you know, if everybody who was there that night had actually just used the pub a bit more, it would have been a very different story. So it turned into a community pub, which, you know, community pubs have their challenges. But really, it was just the same people who used it before. So, you know, I think very much that if you are a person who moves to a village, you know, and people are different, right? Some people aren't into socializing and so on, but I think you do have a responsibility to contribute to the community and to the culture, you know, where you get these villages where people are only really there at the weekend or whatever, or they just kind of move there and shut themselves away. You know, it's no good.
Yeah, and one of the things I noticed when I was doing the research in Bashchurch for the piece, and I spent a lot of time in this village. There was the Pilates class, and then I went to a couple of parish council meetings and just went knocking on doors, real old-fashioned journalism that I haven't done for a long time, and I really enjoyed. And one of the things I noticed is, let's use the word incomer in inverted commas, but with each new wave of incomers, they then want to stop any more coming. And I spoke to multiple generations of people that had moved in. So some had moved in 40 years ago, 30 years ago, 20 years ago, 5 years ago. And, you know, they're each time they witness more development in the village. So another set of housing goes up and then another and another. And I asked one of them who'd moved in, when was it? 2 years ago, 2022, was it? And I said to her, I was like, so, you know, where, and she, bearing in mind she lives in a new build, one of the newest buildings in the village. And I said, oh, and she was saying, oh, it's quite lonely sometimes. And, you know, there's, when I walk, there's, you know, there's not so much to do for my age group, because she was in her mid 30s. And I said, oh, would it be nice if there was more for you to do and, you know, a little bit more development? And she said, oh, I don't want any more development. And I said, well, so but I was like, but you're in one of the new builds. And I said, when has it hit the ceiling? And she said, oh, now, no more. So it's almost like every wave of incomers wants to preserve the village at the point at which they find it. And they don't want it to change anymore beyond. But the thing is, at the point that they found it, it's massively different to how it would have looked compared to when, you know, the old boy that you met was a little boy. So we only ever know a village how we have experienced it. And we want to preserve it at that stage in its journey. So it's very bizarre.
And what do you think the future is of the, I just wonder how. I heard a story the other day from somebody who was telling me that she remembers, quite an old lady now, she was saying that when she was young, boys in the village that she lives in and that she's always lived in used to always fish in a stream on a Sunday. It was their thing. They would always go on a Sunday and fish in a stream, all the boys in the village. And she said, you know, it just struck her recently that they don't do it anymore. And she wonders what they kind of do. And, you know, and I just wonder, you know, are young families going to move from rural villages more and more? I mean, what is the future of the village, do you think, in England? How's it going to change in terms of demographics?
Well, they'll just get older and richer and whiter. And, well, actually, they can't get any whiter, but they can get older and they can get richer. And I think that's what's going to happen. And it will, if we're not careful, we're going to create really homogenized communities where everyone looks the same, sounds the same, dresses the same, is the same socioeconomic status. They're just going to become extremely uniform places with extremely uniform people in.
Yeah, it's really interesting. I also think there's a thing that I was in Lincolnshire the other day at a very big vegetable producer. And I mean, it was a really impressive farm, but the farm wasn't connected really to a local village in any way. And once upon a time, that would have been fairly common. You know, farms needed people. So farms existed, particularly, I think, in arable areas, kind of in villages, and the whole thing was bound up together. But I think that you'll probably end up with villages almost being kind of more and more isolated from the countryside around them, if that makes sense.
Oh, yeah, that's definitely another thing I noticed. The idea that a rural community understands farming is a misnomer completely. And I think, and that was really interesting when I was writing the book, was how farming and rural communities really get lumped in together, but they're massively different.
They're hugely different, yeah.
And that's a really tangled one to get into. That's probably a subject for another
another day. And I mean, it does get. I was chatting to a young kennel huntsman recently, and obviously hunting's a controversial and complicated topic, but he was saying that they're no longer able to meet in the local village on Boxing Day because there are a sufficient number of people in the village now who don't like it. And, you know, whether people agree with hunting or disagree with it, I mean, that's a real change. So he was saying that, you know, they have to kind of meet, you know, far away kind of thing at some, you know, little farmhouse down the end of a lane. And you know, that's really interesting.
Oh, yeah, that is, and that makes me sad. Yeah. I think, you know, if you're going to move to a rural village, you've got to be prepared to see some rural stuff.
Yeah.
And there might be stuff in the rural culture that you're uncomfortable with, but you've decided to step into that culture. It's like if you go traveling, you don't go traveling and expect the culture to change for you because you're a tourist.
Unless you're a sort of missionary.
Yeah. Unless you're a missionary.
Yeah.
But yeah, that really does wind me up when people move into communities that have been doing things for many, many years quite happily and then want to change it immediately.
It is strange, isn't it? I mean, obviously, you know, I write a lot about shooting. I'm sort of quite involved in shooting. But at the same time, I like to think that and there was a situation that a gamekeeper was telling me about the other day where they don't shoot a bit of meadowland anymore because it's close to a village and people don't like it. And he said, but before, we always used to do it. And I think lots of the beaters on this particular shoot came from the village and they come from further afield now. And it's just, you know, I like to think that even if I disliked shooting on some level, and actually there are things that I do dislike about shooting, I would still be able to think, you know, it's shooting has been part of rural communities for a long time and that is worth something.
Yeah, I agree completely. I think sensitivity to a local culture, wherever you are in the world, is a fundamental part of just being a kind person.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
I think, when you've been in that community a long time and you've taken the time to get to know people who are into the shooting or the hunting or the farming or whatever it might be, and you've built some experience of it, you've built some relationships and some friendships, then you can start questioning it and going,
yeah.
But why do you do that? And I'm not sure what I think about that. And you know, you have to learn it first, question it second.
Yeah. Well, you can only really question it meaningfully if you've taken time to learn about it.
If you just shoot from the hip and, well, forgive the shooting pun, but if you just kind of turn up, judge, and then shake things up, that's not going to create community cohesion. And I think this is why we've got so many of these divides. When we talk about urban-rural divide, when we talk about divides in the villages, it's because people aren't taking the time to understand. And I must say, though, it works the other way. I work more with the farming community. I don't really know the shooting or hunting community very well at all. It's more the farming community I work with.
Yeah.
And often they'll just make wild assumptions about people that have moved into the village. And like almost hysterical. I'm like, where does that come from? Where does that opinion that you have made about this person that has moved in, where does that come from? And there can be a real lack of empathy with people that move in, a kind of almost waiting for them to put a foot wrong.
Yeah.
You know, it's sort of like, I've decided that I don't like these people and I'm just waiting for them to piss me off.
Yeah.
And I find that uncharitable. I find that unkind.
I know. I totally agree with what you're saying. I think that there is an interesting, I was thinking about this the other day, is that when you're a farmer, right, when you're at work in a community. So it's sort of this odd thing whereby, like, if I was sitting there writing an article and someone knocked on my door and said, excuse me, I'm actually just doing a little bit of work and I was wondering, would you be able to look at these sentences I've put together? And it's a bit like, you know, we expect, and I think some farmers really like this, but, you know, if we go off the road or if we get stuck in the mud or whatever, I think there's an expectation that farmers are just going to come and help us because that's what farmers do. But, you know, being a farmer is so hard. And do you know what I mean about, like, your work sort of puts you right in the centre of a community, but you have to kind of, you know, smile and wave in your tractor and so on in a way that we maybe wouldn't expect.
I don't know. I know a lot of farmers that do not smile and wave. I don't know. I think we might be overpainting the jolly farmer image. Look, yeah, I do know. Like, my dad has fished countless people out of the ditch in the snow or in the mud or whatever. And he usually gives them, as he's doing it, he sort of berates them for not having the right tires or for not having a tow bar or whatever.
He probably loves it. I often think farmers.
He's like, what are you doing with a car like this living around here? Bloody stupid car for living around here. You know, so he, I would say, you know, he gives them a piece of his mind as he's doing it. Yeah. So, yeah, I think the there can be not always a good understanding of how busy farmers are or the deadline, the deadlines that farmers are under. I don't think people quite understand that.
Yeah, it's that hilarious thing of you know, why are they combining in the middle of the night? And you know, I mean, that's valid, and there are sort of conservation concerns around doing that. But you know what I mean? It's this sort of expectation of like, well, I clocked off at five, so you know, so should they, because you know, I want to set it in my garden. It should.
Yeah, that wouldn't. If I was a farmer, that would really annoy me. So again, it comes back to that you're moving into another culture. Yeah. You're moving into a community that works differently. It's not 9 to 5. There will be tractors going up and down the road in the middle of the night with their big lights and making noise and up and about early. And there will be poo on the road. People are really shocked about poo on the road. And it's like, well, yeah, it's muck spreading. There's going to be poo on the road.
Yeah.
And it's those are the things that when you move in, it's okay to find them a bit unsettling at first. If you're not used to driving on poo in the road, then maybe that's a bit, but at least give yourself time to get used to it before you get angry about it. And one thing I wanted to say about farming and rural communities being different is as a journalist, and because I make programs that are generally for the mainstream rather than specialist trade press, I do get it in the neck a lot that, you know, I need to be more like Clarkson's Farm and not and don't like Country File and all these kind of things. And they'll say that farming doesn't get enough of a platform.
Mm.
And recently someone said, oh, farming and the rural way of life don't get enough of a platform. And I said, well, actually, farming's got a hell of a platform. If you look at Clarkson's Farm and all the programmes about farming, we were talking earlier about rural communities, and I'm not talking about farming or hunting or shooting. I'm talking about people that might not have anything to do with any of those things, but still live in deeply rural areas.
Yeah.
Often really quite underprivileged areas. There's pockets of deep poverty in the countryside.
Yes.
And where is their voice? Mm. Where is the program about their world? It's just non-existent. The public has a lot of content around farming. And actually a lot, if you want.
Yeah, it does. Yeah,
and I suddenly
agree.
Thought, I was like, rural communities are just a hidden section of society.
But then I think there's a misconception as well that, I mean, you know, I think, you know, I used to live next to a lady called Nikki, who was a gas meter reader, who was a very keen follower of the local hunt and sort of, I think, you know, and also people who are into their beating and so on. I mean, I remember a while ago being at a shoot in Devon, and the day was delayed because one of the beaters, who was a very old guy, hadn't turned up. So some of the other beaters went to go and see where he was, and he'd had a stroke and was lying on his bathroom floor.
Oh, gosh. And
these were guys, you know, who really didn't have very much at all. So there's a kind of there's a misconception, I think, that that, you know, farmers have it easy, and also that shooting and hunting is just all about toffs on horses, or, you know, toffs standing there in the field.
There is that.
But actually, you know, it brings communities together. And I do think that people would be quite taken aback. Some people who sort of badmouth field sports, if they went along to a hunt meet in rural Devon and met the people who actually, you know, are there and who follow it enthusiastically.
Oh, completely, completely. But then we don't see those people enough. I had a big debate recently about all of this. Because it's those voices that we desperately need to hear more of. They're often the shyer voices. They're more reserved. They like to just get on with it. They're not necessarily the people that would put themselves forward to champion country sports. But they're the people who should be pushed forward.
Yeah.
And if they're not confident, be given the help to feel confident talking about it. Because the public love So most people in this country are your ordinary sort of lower to middle income people. That's your average British person. And your average British person would have more in common with a gamekeeper or a beater than they might with somebody who goes shooting or is on a horse.
Yeah.
Like, to be honest, they probably would have more to talk about. And so why we're not putting forward those people, because I think they're much more relatable.
Yeah. But it's just also a disconnect. I mean, people don't know look, today, it's funny we're having this conversation about rural villages, but I'm here in SE5, and, today I was in a very posh part of Peckham, went to the butcher, and I was writing yesterday about two wildfowlers I went to go and visit in Hull who worked there. As they both actually wanted to go on the cod fleet, but their mother, they're quite old guys, their mother wouldn't let them because it was so dangerous. So they ended up working in shipbuilding, sort of manual labouring stuff. And, if I took those guys to see this street in Peckham, they would be blown away by it, sort of like steaks for 15 quid kind of thing. And it's really interesting. I think that the divide in Britain and sort of this sort of gets back to the village point is so great that people don't actually know these people exist, which is fascinating and sad and worrying.
And that is why Clarkson's Farm is such a success. Yes, it needed Clarkson's profile to get made in the first place, because Amazon Prime would never have made a program about Caleb. They needed Clarkson to be the person to do it.
But that's really interesting.
That is why it's loved. It's not because of Clarkson. It's loved because it's the first program that has given a big platform to the Charlies, the Geralds, the Calebs. Yeah. And they are the underrepresented.
When I wrote a book about 2 years ago that was trying to do this. It was trying to go around Britain to talk to people who sort of work on the land, and quite a lot of kind of working class.
We could never pull it off though, Patrick, because we're not Jeremy Clarkson.
Well, that's true.
Unfortunately, you've got to have A-list celebrity status. Yeah.
You can do it in book form though.
You can do it, but it's not going to cut through. Like, Caleb is a massive celeb now, selling out theatres.
Yeah, yeah. No, it is a good thing to see. But definitely, I mean, I think from sort of the middle class nature world, there is a little bit of why would you speak to these people and not speak to the person who's got a PhD in whatever, raptor ecology.
I hate that snobbery. I really hate. I remember when I first started working at the BBC, I found a farmer that had really great on the ground experience of bovine TB and had kind of was sort of tracking trends, I suppose. But because he'd been farming a very long time, could see those trends. And I really thought it was interesting, and I pitched it to the producer, and it was just dissed as, oh, it's only anecdotal. And they actually asked me, is it peer reviewed?
I was like
no, of course it's not peer reviewed. It's an ordinary person's life experience. But why is that not valued?
But it is funny because we both know of writers who are hugely acclaimed, hugely educated, but they flick from issue to issue to issue. And you see them tweeting things and writing things and saying things, and you just think, oh my goodness, how have you got this so wrong? Things like, mixing a Chinese water deer and a muntjac up or whatever. But we listen to them because they talk posh and they've got a PhD. And it's nuts, really.
It really is, honestly. It really is.
But this whole conversation's taken us. We've gone so far.
Oh my god, we've gone on a tangent.
Off the village. Let's wrap up. So I think there are two things that I would love people who are listening to this podcast to do. The first of which is I'd love you to go to Snoring and go and visit the egg vending machine, because it's just really something to see. And I think if you
and it's all you can buy there.
Yeah, well, you can buy walnuts as well.
Because
the walnuts are also in the vending machine. You can buy hen's eggs, but it is interesting. And I think if you go there and you use the vending machine and you just have a wander around, and it's a really beautiful place. But if you think about how much has gone, it's a really interesting symbol, I think, of how rural England has changed. And also, I think buy Anna's book, because this whole notion of the divide cuts through so much of British culture, so much of British rural culture. And I think if we can get beyond the divide, then we will be in a much better place. Anna, lastly, do you think there is any hope of getting beyond the divide and getting people to talk to each other more and listen to each other more?
I think I was more hopeful of that when I was writing the book, but now the dust has settled, I feel a little bit less hopeful because sometimes it feels like a mountain to climb. It depends if people, this is what it comes down to, if people want to bridge the divide.
Yeah.
Because the thing that holds the divide in place is that a lot of people are very comfortable living in their clique, living in their echo chamber, living with people who are like them. Unless you have a desire to break out of that, then we're never going to get over the divide because, frankly, the divide serves some people because they want to maintain a moat around their particular culture. And if you're not going to be outward looking, if you insist on being inward looking, then we're never going to bridge it. But if, like we said earlier, you choose to be led by your curiosity rather than your judgment in life, then we will bridge the divide. But that's each individual's choice.
I agree. I think that sadly we do live in a time when, you know, division is a really profitable thing, you know, and people want to know, you know, what side you're on. But I think that, you know, if you live in a village, you can make that village a better place and you can make that community a richer one by doing things, you know, by starting things and participating in things and talking to people and listening to people. It's the hottest day of the year so far and I'm sitting here in my kitchen with the evening sun streaming through the windows. I've just opened a beer and I've got two jars of pickled quail's eggs sitting in front of me. I've had, I think, three or four of the saffron ones and I've lost count now of how many I've had of the other ones. I'm such a fan of these eggs that next time I'm in Norfolk, which is going to be in a fortnight's time for a pond restoration course, I'm going to buy a jar, I'm going to go back to the vending machine, and I'm going to post that jar out to one of you who shares the link, the Spotify link, to this episode in your Instagram story. So we'll pick a winner and we will send you a jar of pickled quail's eggs. 5-star reviews are great. But what makes an even bigger difference is a personal recommendation. So if you know somebody who would like to have been sitting there under that walnut tree with me and David Perrone, then why not tell them about Beyond the Hedge? We've had a lot of really nice feedback so far, and we've got some very interesting adventures planned. We've got stuff coming up on English cheese, on pig farming, on tenant farming. We might even do something about mythology in Suffolk. So do continue to join us as we head out across Britain in search of the interesting.